Okay, I think we are recording now, hopefully, through the elaborate means of OBS.
All
So,
praise OBS.
this is the second of the we're calling these, apparently we're now calling these uplink or the uplink, which is a section of the Startup Community newsletter. I did previously ask our guest here, which who is I'm going to try to pronounce your name this through hand this time. Volosaurus. Is
Yep,
that you
you got
pronounce
it.
it? There you go. Although I can also use first names if you want, but that's not a necessity here. And today we're having him on to have a chat about Star Control and RPGs in general as well, I'd say. So hello, Volosaurus, which is
Hi.
I'm just gonna evolve from now on. That's
Yeah,
easier.
it's less of a mouthful there.
Less. So yeah, why don't you start by just introducing yourself and what your history is with Star Control.
Well, I'm Vol. I guess I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, with a degree in game design. That's what I spent about 3+ years in school for. I've been a volunteer moderator for the Star Control Discord for over a year, almost 2 years now.
Yeah, it's been a while now.
I don't remember the
Time
exact date.
flies.
Everything's been kind of a jumble. And I've been known to dabble in fan music for the classic Star Control games, as well as providing new ambient loops and themes for Cirrhosis's Mega Mod, which, if you have not played it yet, that is, in my opinion, the definitive way to play classic Star Control now. Lots of cool options there for if you want to customize your experience.
And of course, both you and Ancerosis, but were original founders for Star Control Origins, and
Yes, we
have
were.
been involved pretty. I mean, actually, before me as well, because I kind of joined in a bit later on. Like, I did notice it and was interested when it was first like announced, but like, I didn't really get involved until like near the close of the like I think it was when the first real beta for the fleet battles was actually ready, and then when I personally started to get involved with that. But I think you were involved before then as well on the forums and with
The fallout there. Those were dark times. So I was actually there in the very first batch of founders. I was there from day one, and that was a really exciting time to be there because we had no idea what Origins was going to be. We knew it was a new Star Control game, and there were images floating around of the Mouquet was one of the very first things that caught my eye. Because we had that early art available to us.
Well,
But in
some
terms
of
of
that,
go ahead.
I was gonna say some of the early art was especially fantastic. I think the Mouquet definitely stood out. Like that was once like, okay, this is interesting.
There was also a it was a proto Trandall around that time that I know Brad didn't like it, but I immediately fell in love with this dumb head guy. It was just a head with a monitor attached to it, and he just looked so dumb, and it was so great, like these weird tentacles hanging out.
I mean, Baz literally posted like I think some like hundreds of like different like small concepts, et cetera. Like a lot of stuff was coming through, which happens with big art projects. But I know the channel especially, they've gone through a lot of designs and redesigns, and I think we can't really speak to, I think too much because there is an NDA there by that stuff. But I think we can s say enough that like the early Trandals, like some of the earlier but not the earliest Trandals. You and I actually had some fun with some of the first dialogue for that, which I found kind of oddly like endearing, but probably because my trace my sorry my tastes are kind of trashy, and I feel that's something that we share. This is all like leaf speak, which is awful.
Oh man, that I wanted to be the voice for that so bad. That would have been fantastic. Leet nub good. Anyway, so as for Star Control itself, there's no way to talk about this without sounding a little bit conceited. Sorry. My dad worked at Accolade in the early 90s. He started off as a QA guy there, but then he ended up moving up through the ranks as he proved he was able to do audio engineering and whatnot. which was a field that there was no real formal training for back then. I mean, there were people dabbling in synthesizers, but that wasn't quite the same. And as a result, because he was an employee, we had a bunch of Star Control stuff around the house, like, all the time. We had, you know, two different box copies of Star Control 2, and we had the Star Control collection that was, you know, 1 and 2 as a CD package, and we had all the maps, and that was that. I had an obsession with it when I was very young. You know, I was about 2 or 3 when Star Control 2 was released. You know, I drew the ships in chalk on the sidewalk. My vocabulary grew exponentially as a result of playing the games over and over and over again. And, you know, my mom hated it, which in turn accelerated my reading comprehension.
I've noticed that's a very common thing with a lot of, like, especially. I suppose I'd have to say, like, those geeks, I guess, probably was in vogue to say that, is that when you're young, like, it's something which you either read or played, or something which usually kind of exposed to a lot of more complicated and adult language. Personally, I remember reading, I'm not joking, Dune when I was like 11 or something, which was really dumb. Exactly. I didn't read Tolkien, but I read Dune. I read Herbert.
I don't know which evil is worse. not that there's anything wrong with those. I could go on forever about that, but you know me. I'm super verbose. So.
Yeah. So anyway, you grew up kind of having a surprisingly close relationship with it, especially because of your father, of course, worked faculty at the time. So between then, like, because obviously, like, Star Control, it changed hands a couple times and was kind of, like, forgotten to the mist of time. For some, not necessarily for all. But what would you say then? I mean, I'm going to go for a bit of a curveball here. Like, speaking more generally as well about RPGs now, because something I found interesting about RPGs is that how it's... and it's when I mean RPGs in this context, it's specifically video game RPGs, is that... there are so many different types of RPGs, technically. I mean, you have JRPGs, you have Western RPGs, you have sandbox RPGs, you have all kinds of different styles and variations, first person, third person, etc., like all the controls and variety. And Star Control itself has a very unique style. I mean, many people compare Mass Effect to, like, the style of, like, building a crew and kind of going on these adventures and meeting new aliens, but
yeah,
the control-wise and, like, the actual mechanics are very, very different, obviously. What would you say, I'm curious about this, is kind of the defining quality of what is most compelling about a video game RPG? And what kind of unites all of them for players?
I think role-playing video games give players an opportunity to play out selected flavors of fantasy, you know, sci-fi, post-apoc, traditional fantasy, etc. And I say that because... when you're dealing with a video game, you have limited resources as a developer, right? So it's like, well, we have to choose, this is the genre we're making. This is the style of combat that we're going to have. This is how you're going to interact with characters. But they're all still an extension of that classic pen and paper sort of RPG, right? Like, it's just, you have a computer taking care of the DM role. The dice spoke. It's what they said. They're going to do it.
They do. And I've had... times where I wanted to kill an NPC and I couldn't because the dice kept stopping it for me. Why? Yeah, go on.
But, you know, as a whole, I think role-playing games are satisfying because they give players a sense of making vague and nebulous concepts like progression and adventure, you know, like with experience bars or whatever, into a tangible experience. And there are some that would argue that having a verbose user interface in front of them somehow makes the experience better than if it were pen and paper. I'm partial to both. It doesn't matter to me, but, you know. Mm-hmm. And with Star Control as an RPG, I think what's cool is that it doesn't draw from cookie-cutter sci-fi experiences. It's not Star Wars. It's not quite Star Trek. It's not quite Battlestar Galactica, you know, or Babylon 5 or whatever. It falls into this great category where you can be Captain Kirk in command of the Red Dwarf while fighting evil space empires that feel real and alive.
I definitely Yeah, I mean, I would probably, from my perspective, would say that, and you mentioned it very briefly, like, I think one of the key components for any RPG experience is the sense of progression. And that's not necessarily means that numbers going up. I mean, typically people think of, like, yes, I leveled up, but it's not just that, like, whatever kind of experience it is, there has to be some feeling of, like, I'm going somewhere. Like, this
Right,
is.
like there need to be like your the consequences of your actions, good or bad, have to feel like you made an impact.
And I would also add to that, like, it has to be feeling like you're not just in the one place all the time. Because a lot of other games, you can get away. I wouldn't say get away, but like, you can boil it down to a single location or a single kind of set of tools. But with an RPG, there's an expectation in one way or another that you're always like meeting new characters, you're always going new places, you're always getting new gear. So whatever it is. With any RPG, I would say there's always some sense of like things are constantly changing until, of course, you're done with the game. And there's has to be very clear beginning, middle, and end to that. Whereas with other games, it can be a lot to like you can still have that with them to a degree, but RPGs, especially video game RPGs, I'd say encapsulate that kind of feeling of there was a build up here. And I think there's also a reason why very often, and in the case of Dark Control as well. Pretty much every Star Trek experience, I think, and many RPG experiences have that zero to hero story.
Absolutely. The way that SEO especially approaches it, I think, what's cool is that sense of progression has, I hate to pull from this cliche, but it draws parallels with the hero's journey. And, we see this in fiction all the time. And in Star Control, without getting into spoiler territory for people who haven't played it, you definitely have this arc where you're a nobody, you don't want to be involved, you're forced to be involved, and suddenly you're on this grand quest and meeting all these people, and you lose something along the way, and it's something that hurts, but then you realize that, you had to lose that to grow, for example.
The loss of innocence very often. I think that's definitely like one of the like core themes of like it starts and you're like it's like oh everything'll be fine like no everything is a lot worse than you thought it was like and again I probably say that it is a cliche in many ways but I think that especially with video game RPGs that's very very common in every story is like some kind of like the Sephiroth moment right it's with moment in
Right.
which it's like I think I'm getting as well I'm thinking it somewhere as well progression is going there and then turns out no you're being kicked down back into the pit. Good luck finding light again.
Kind of a Evil Dead sort of thing.
Less chainsaw hands probably in general with the game. Although I'm not thinking about it, could really go for like a giant just chainsaw on the ship.
Yeah, a melee ship. Yeah, go around jousting with your giant chainsword.
Now you're going to get me on to talking about anime and one of the more insane animes that group with Outlaw Star. That show. You know that one. All right, you know that one. Because that was about a literal ship that was all about grappling with the spaceships with robot arms. And a magic gun. I don't know why, but it had magic bullets. I remember that. We should probably move on to another question, I think, maybe. This one you have also answered in the official question, but you would answer would be written down, of course, on the post. But all-time favorite alien. And you did answer for SEO, but I'd also say like more generally as well, like of all time, perhaps, because there's a lot of fictional aliens and like I'd probably even include fantasy to some degree, if you want to expand on that.
So all-time favorite alien ever. Oh man, that's a hard one. Because like if it's just choosing from SEO, easy hands down, it's got to be the Pinthy, because the idea of this living weapon that's fully aware of its function and purpose, living in
Oh,
existence.
gotta be careful that spoilers too much.
Oh, yep.
But yes, the Pinthi, which not too many spoilers, I think, but just saying that they are a living weapon. Nobody does beyond that, I think. But yeah, the essential thing of like something that is self-aware, and that's something which does get explored a few times in sci-fi about kind of a thing which is like, I was created for one reason, but you know, what is your purpose? You pass the butter.
Like I like the idea. Like, I guess I don't have an individual favorite alien. I have a favorite trope, though, and that's the alien that is completely unaware of its origins. It knows it's dangerous. It knows it's bad, but it can't do anything about it, and so it's just progressively living in existential dread. Like, ooh, this idea of there was one of those in Mass Effect that wasn't the Geth and it wasn't the Reapers. The hive, the weird bug things.
The Rachni, I think you're talking about.
Rachni, yeah, those guys. Like, something about that where it's a collective that's sentient and aware as an individual, it's sapient, just feels really good to me because it's very alien. And that's what I like about aliens, okay? I like that they are not human. And when I see things like Twi'lek or, you know, Wookiees or whatever, it's like, oh, cool, it's just a human but this. It's a human but that. And that seems really boring to me.
That, I think, one of the... I'm going to do a mic moment from Red Letter Media here and talk about Star Trek for a minute. Because Star Trek is definitely a big inspiration for a lot of this. And, like, Star Trek isn't necessarily the most original science fiction. Like, there are things they borrow and even stolen from other people over time. But they're definitely, like, one of the most, like, prolific and influencing other people, especially of this generation, like, era of people creating stuff. And that includes Star Control. That includes Mass Effect. Like almost everyone owes something to that kind of... That era and that imagination being put on display. Right. When it comes to space and science fiction in that way, one of the more interesting aliens in that show, of course, was the Borg, and that became, you know, one of the biggest villains of all time for science fiction. You know, I mean, even I would argue possibly that even if you've never really watched Star Trek, you probably know the line, "Resistance is futile."
Right. I mean, they've become a narrative meme almost.
Pop culture. And one of the things people don't know about the Borg is that originally they weren't meant to be cyborgs or like humanoid in any way. They were meant to be very, very alien. They're meant to be like bug-like creatures. But they didn't have the budget for it. So they thought, we'll make them like cyborgs. But that idea of being so inhuman, so alien, especially when they're first in the show in TNG. Later on, they kind of made them more human, like with the Queen. But early on, especially, they were very much like, "This is you're not talking to an individual. You're not talking to something which has as feelings or likes or fears or anything like that. It's like it's so alien. It's this hive mind, which is only interested in what it can get out of you. Like even if you go onto their ship and start like milling around, they'll ignore you until you become a problem. They don't care." Like, that is so intrinsically like, okay, this is really weird. This is very beyond what we would normally consider to be like, what we would expect life to be like or react. Even though, of course, in that case, it was explicitly a cyborg, but still.
Yeah, no. And I don't want to spoil Orville, but it touches on that idea very well as well.
There's a couple things in there. Although when it comes to the Orville, I think I actually quite like the Silaeans.
That's such a cool concept.
I think the Silaeans, it's so weird though, because this isn't really spoilers though. It's like just basic information about the race, which is not meant to be like super secret. But to anyone who hasn't watched the Orville, the Silaeans are an alien in that show who are basically philosophers. They're basically like a bit like Vulcans in Star Trek, but they have emotions. They're great scientists. They're philosophers. They're artists. Like, they pride themselves in being very cultured and non-militaristic. Only a small number of their citizens ever like want to be guards or soldiers or anything like that. But the really weird thing is that the planet they're on has this really dense gravitational field. Like, it's the mass is insane there. Like it's actually unnaturally so. Like, it's definitely science fiction. Like, this doesn't make any sense. But because of that, whenever members of their race, like, go off-world, they're basically, like, you know, something like 100 times stronger than any other humanoid.
Like, they become they're kryptonite, or Kryptonians.
Yeah, but they're like Superman, yeah, that, like, word. Not quite with all the superpowers that find around, etc., that they probably jump pretty far if they wanted to on a, like, Earth or someplace. But effectively, you know, they don't need to really work on being able to, like, arm this or someone ever, hold them down, have you. And yet, by and large, their culture is incredibly, you know, pacifistic, really.
Yeah, they're kind of an inverse of humanity, which is still being a humanoid race.
Although I would probably argue the Vulcans were more the way. The Vulcans, though, kind of, they're definitely space elves. Like, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Every sci-fi also has a version of elves. Like, Star Trek, it was Vulcans. Actually, for Galactic Civilizations, we actually have the Altarians, very clearly elf-inspired. And although my favorite space elves have got to be the Minbari from Babylon 5, which, again, is kind of seen as being similar connection with, like, that style of, like, multiple alien races and interactions with, like, Mass Effect and Star Control, where you have different cultures clashing.
Right, right. Planet of Hats is kind of prevalent in that sort of sci-fi, but I think in that setting it works, whereas in Star Control there's less of a, you know, a Planet of Hats thing going on.
That and just fantastic actors, but...
Yeah.
So, getting back to Star Control, and in particular, again, this is a question you have answered officially, but kind of officially, we've written an answer for this, but just to go over it in the voice interview, as it were. What do you think about the Founders Program, in particular how it went with Star Control Origins, and, like, the general notion of, like, having a program where game devs allow people to pre-order a game, but also be hyper-involved with early on kind of development, which is very much seeing the sausages be made.
Right, right, the sausage factory concept. I have mixed feelings about the Founders Program. Mm. I like that fans can contribute directly to the initial funding of a project and watch it grow, and, you know, you have your input being heard by devs, and they can see it immediately, and it's put in. Like, the Discord was a fantastic transition. I'm 100% behind every company that does a Founders Program or early access having a Discord specifically for it. Just because that instantaneous communication is great.
Yeah, I think you need that real-time communication. Forums are great for, like, long-form stuff, but for, like, immediate kind of, like, getting question-answer and, like, refining, like, what do you mean by this thing, it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of more efficient for that. Or at least it certainly feels better, I think, for people. Mm-hmm. Whether it is better or not, I don't know. Like, I'm not... I'm actually a very pro-Discord person myself, personally, but, like, there is an argument, like what styles of feedback communication, different areas. I think there is a role to be served with different types of communication and the form factor for it.
Yeah, like, you know, do you set up a slow-mo channel instead versus, which is a fairly relatively new function for Discord, so... I'm sure if that had been around when the Founders Program started, we would have, like, initially had a feedback channel that was like that. But I think that some founders get the idea that they're somehow shareholders or something because of the status, and so that their input has to be followed by the law, or else you're not doing your part as a dev. You know, and I don't mean to be, I'm not trying to mock anyone, it's just, it feels kind of entitled and disingenuous, you know? Like, it feels like they get a sense of authority that they don't really have.
And so you're looking at it more from the game dev point, that point, then, of course.
I'm looking at it from both sides. As a dev, it would feel to me like if I was getting some of this feedback and it's, like, really just kind of rude and not really taking the amount of effort into these changes into account, I would kind of feel insulted. But as a fan of whatever it is, or as a founder, that also kind of feels disrespectful to me, because it's like, oh, so only this person's feedback is important as opposed to everyone's.
I think that's where the importance of put the onus on myself here for a second, like, community management comes in, and the idea of, like, one of the things I've noticed increasingly, and a lot of other people talk about as well when it comes to the community teams, is that there is a certain knack to like cutting through what people are passionate about, because that's an ongoing kind of I don't want to say issue exactly, but like area of improvement and refinement in the game communities in general. Because in many ways, even with big companies, gamers and developers are closer than before. The internet, I mean, games itself is like the most modern, the most adaptive and constant changing art form around. There's nothing compares to it. It is the frontier of all entertainment, pretty much. Like Hollywood wishes it was as dynamic as you know, half of an ounce of the game industry is. That has pros and that has cons. And one of the things that we're facing is the issue of like, including with social media, is like the idea of like, people are going to be passionate. People are going to feel quote unquote entitled. And sometimes that can be people generally being pretty out there, but very often it's just people who feel strong about something. They may not necessarily know the best way to communicate or understand the best way to like get to what particularly, you know, is bothering them, and they want to have some kind of, you know, feedback on it. And one of the jobs, one of the roles I would say for someone like me and many other people in the industry is to figure out how we cut through what people are saying and what is actually the issue, what is bothering them, and how do we at the very least kind of explain, you know, communicate what we're doing, or if there is something which we can do, we can change, which will better address that.
Right.
And that is.
Go ahead.
And that, well, I'm just saying that's the thing, and that's something which happens both like internally and very publicly. And that's not really kind of, I wouldn't say that's unique to a founder program or to an early access program or to a Kickstarter or to like all these different things. Like, it's something which happens across the board, whether the game is public or not. One of the things actually if I find amusing is when people start to like get really angry about an early access game where it's like, it is early access, but then people are also used to, unfortunately, some games being in early access for a long, long time. And that can be like, well, if I don't, you know, make a stink now, then, you know, nothing's going to happen about it.
Right. You know, 5-6 years into development and your feedback has gone unheard, that feels kind of bad. Like, I totally get that.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it hasn't been unheard, but it's just, it's unreasonable for them to act on it right away. And so like, and that's the thing that isn't always necessarily being communicated is, you know, sometimes, and this is speaking from experience programming myself, you know, you'll go to fix one thing and then suddenly something that you did here breaks something completely unrelated and you have no idea why. And so suddenly, you know, what was supposed to be a 1 week task became a 3 month task.
Something always breaks. Always.
Always.
We actually had a day just recently where like I think something broke like 5 times over before we got like the fixes in, but it's like it's amazing how many times it comes as like we're gonna update today and it's like the build something broke something here, something broke something there, etc. It's like, wow, it's just sometimes things just don't fall into order like that, and very often when it comes to game dev especially, like it is definitely like the final kind of picture of what a game's going to be happens in the final like 5%.
Yeah.
Like up until that point, you don't know what's going to work out or not.
And that's the time when the designer and the producer and, you know, maybe some of the writers and programmers just want to collectively pick up the entire project and just toss it into the sun. We're done with this. It's done forever. Bye.
But that's what makes it so fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, anything worth doing isn't easy.
Yeah, exactly.
In the words of JF Kennedy, we choose to go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I just compared game dev to the moon landing, which of course is completely accurate. Like, we are literally astronauts doing this.
And we'll probably NASA. Die doing it.
Maybe if you're playing Kerbal Space Program, yeah. So we should probably wrap this up now because we've been rambling on for quite a while. Yeah, I think we've gone through most of the official questions I like wrote out for a while now. Of course, I'm going to have to ask you briefly. I've got to actually make a boot mention as well, because today we actually have released a part two of the Earth Rising expansion. So that is a thing. And that includes another, I've got to be careful here because spoilers, but technically it's an alien, but technically also not from a human perspective, because it's an introduction of the Lexites, like their official kind of entrance into the universe, or like reintroduction, technically. But I'll leave it to players to find out. So before we wrap this up, do you have anything you want to plug?
I'm currently working on a game project that was heavily inspired by a lot of the games that I played growing up. So, you know, there's a little bit of StarCraft, there's a little bit of Star Control, there's, you know, just all these things that I loved that I want to make into something cool and unique. And I want to make this setting fun and enjoyable for everyone playing it. And I really like found family games. You know, where you have this group of people who have no reason to be together, but they're there and they have to work together for, you know, whatever common goal it is. And they learn to love each other, basically.
And love is a strong word.
Tolerate.
Did the crew of Red Dwarf love each other? I'm not sure. Like,
No.
There's loyalty of a kind, but love...
That's probably a better... that's a better comparison there. Now they can fall in love, though. That is a thing that we have.
Love until something better comes along.
Yes, exactly. And it's called Canary Crew. I can provide a little link here. There we go.
This is well being recorded live now, so everyone who's listening to this will have found this link. But yes, we'll include a link, of course, to what you're able to check out. Canary Crew. So, do you have any anything else you want to add until, or any like topics until we close out?
Trying to think. I mean, I've got that tentative SEO remix album coming out this year at some point. Oh. Eventually.
So there'll be remix and everything with Riku and Mason and... That's a lot of tracks to remix, really.
I don't know if I would do the entire thing. I may do something closer to what I did with Star Control 2, where I release it in volumes. So, like, one that's the relatively friendly races and one that's the relatively evil races, you know.
You know, I just realized there's an obvious question I should have asked you earlier and I didn't. And that is so obvious. What is your favorite track from Star Control Origins soundtrack? Which is a tough question, isn't it? Now you got to think about it.
It's got to be the Maldlings thing theme, straight the up. Theme. That is... my favorite one, because it's this marriage of old school and new school, and it has like these really cool synths going on, and it feels really fun. It's the tangible, audible version of fun.
Tangible version of fun. Which, I mean, no spoilers, but Marlin is like, that's... I guess. They're probably the most optimistic, well... Yeah, I'd probably say they're the most optimistic or unfazed aliens. Like, they're not really scared of much, shall we say. They probably should be, but they're not.
Death is not the inconvenience it once was.
Death isn't the inconvenience it once was. Now, that's a slogan for some kind of ominous company that's resurrecting corpses or something. That's your new alien concept. Like, death is not the inconvenience it once was. Like, imagine that kind of war cry from like a battleship. Death is not the inconvenience it once was.
And it's played just like out of speakers, like out of an ice cream truck, sort of kind of. As they're passing by, dropping bombs.
Be assured that your deaths are at least 50% less inconvenient than before. What does it mean? They're going to harvest them for organs, I guess. Something. This is convenient. Anyway. Yeah, so I think... I should probably say which is my favorite, but then I shouldn't really alienate any one of our musicians by choosing one above the others. But you chose the Mauna theme is actually a Mason track, so I should probably choose a Riku one to balance it out. So I'd probably go for I'm gonna say the Taiwan theme because it's one of the first themes that was kind of like brought forward and.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's probably one of the more instant ones because it has that slightly tribal sound to it, which I always like that in something.
Go ahead.
It feels kind of like it's got that like something which has that kind of like drums in it. For some reason, to me, feels like kind of alien, but also kind of welcoming or kind of like familiar in some way, which is something that I liked about the theme they had for Farscape as well. They did that as well.
Yeah, I really like that idea as well. Like there's this primal music, just bass that everyone is familiar with.
It's something distant, but also shared somewhere in our consciousness, subconscious somewhere. Like it's not really part of who we are today, but somewhere in our history or our like distant answers or something like we can feel that beat as it were.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the title of that musical though. I don't think I've heard them sing yet. I don't want to. I can't imagine it. So with that, with the mental image or mental echo of singing Taimon, we will put a close to this second episode, technically. It's sort of episodic. Yes, second interview. Thanks for speaking with us, Val.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. Time to close this uplink. Aha, aha.